Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Back in January 2017, Brazil experienced a wave of massive and grisly prison riots. More than 130 inmates were killed that month, mainly from fighting between rival gangs. Many of the dead were decapitated or mutilated, and pictures of their bodies were posted on the internet by other inmates. Now, two other deadly riots in the first few weeks of this year are raising fears of more mass killings in Brazilian prisons. The most recent came just a few days ago, on January 29th, in the northeastern state of Ceará. There, 10 inmates were killed and 8 injured in what was reportedly a gang-related attack. Now, news reports have said that 113 prisoners in that prison had been crammed into a jail built to hold just 25. Now, prisons aren't meant to be nice places, but Brazil's have a reputation for being particularly medieval. And as we'll discuss on the show, the violence they spawn doesn't stop at the prison gate. On this edition of Global Journalist, we're going to take a look at why Brazil's prisons are such violent places and why some say that their mismanagement has become so great as to actually endanger the Brazilian state itself. Now, in a few minutes, we'll hear from a great panel of experts who have been tracking this issue. But first, we're going to bring in Cesar Munoz in Sao Paulo. He visits Brazilian prisons regularly as a senior researcher in Brazil for Human Rights Watch. He also wrote an article in Foreign Affairs last year called Brazil's Correctional House of Horrors. Cesar, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you regularly visit prisons and juvenile detention centers in Brazil. I mean, just tell us, if you were walking into one of these prisons for the first time as an outsider, what would jump out at you?
Well, going into one of Brazil's prisons is like going into a land without law. It's really lawless inside. So you can forget about international standards at the door. You can leave Brazilian law at the door, because the law that regulates conditions is not followed inside the prisons. It's just shocking. In some of these prisons, you know, there is a front area where the guards are, but they stay there. You go on your own. The guards don't go into the prisons in some of these. And so they're...
Well, I'm sorry, did you say the guards don't go into some of the prisons?
That's right, yeah. They stay in the administration area. And then, you know, I've been to prisons where the prisoners themselves had the keys of the cell blocks.
Well, we actually have some video that you made for Human Rights Watch inside a prison, and some sound as well that we're going to play here in just a moment. And so why don't we just take a quick listen to that clip. Well, tell us if you would. I mean, obviously, these prisons have a reputation for being very, very crowded. What's it like? What do you experience when you go into some of these cells?
I've been in cells. I remember one cell I was in Pernambuco, in the state of Pernambuco, where, first of all, an inmate opened the door for me of this cell, right? He had the key. And then you go in, and it was just absolutely packed with men, without shirts, because it was really hot and humid. There were 6 cement bunks there, and there were 60 men inside. And there was not even space on the floor for them to lie down. So they had hammocks, and some of these men had been there for years. I mean, it was just absolutely inhumane.
So you're talking about a cell built for what sounds like 6 people, where 60 yes. people were actually living, right. And the prisoners themselves had the key to the cell. So they sort of had to, I guess, run what happened inside the jail by themselves to some extent. Well, how did we get here? Why are the prisons so crowded?
Well, on average, you have 2 inmates per available space. That's the average. So in some places you have, you know, like that prison in Pernambuco is much worse. There are several factors why you have that situation. First, 40% of people in prison in Brazil are awaiting trial. So it's very high percentage. And many of those shouldn't be there, right? I mean, detention before trial should be the exception and should be reserved for people who are accused of violent crimes and so forth. But you have people accused of theft of dealing with very small amounts of drugs. They are waiting for trial in prison. And they are there together with convicts. So I was in a detention center in November in the north of Brazil. And in the same cell, there was a man who was convicted of murder and a man who had been, who was waiting for trial for stealing a PlayStation, a drill, and some other tools that he found in a house. So the system is just insane, because you have people who are not violent together with, you know, gang members who are going to recruit them.
And so you talked about how in some prisons, literally the guards don't even go into the prison itself. And so it sounds like the prisoners in some cases, gangs are literally organizing what happens inside the prisons. Tell us about how that happens a bit.
Yeah, I was in a prison, for example, and in Pernambuco as well, where there were 2,300 inmates inside, and there were four guards, and they were at the front, because I mean it was not safe for them to go in. So just imagine, they don't have control over what happens inside, and that's very dangerous, because then the inmates themselves organize gangs to protect themselves. That's what happens. I mean, the biggest incentive to join a gang in Brazil is to protect yourself in prison. And of course, you know, once you are a member of the gang, you'll be a member when you get out. So the lack of enough staff to control what is going inside, what's going on, the overcrowding, that facilitates recruitment into gangs.
Well, it sounds like there's a number of different problems here that are sort of intersecting. You talked about how 40% of prisoners haven't even been to trial, and so you have this situation where people who are accused of stealing a PlayStation can be in the same cell for months and months with people who are convicted of murder. Then you have this situation with overcrowding and not enough staff. You mentioned a prison with only four guards for 2,300 inmates, so it sounds like the guards are just basically guarding the door of the prison.
Right.
Talk to us about how has the Brazilian government responded to this situation?
Well, I mean, the prison system is in crisis in Brazil, and it has been in crisis for a long time. I mean, this is the result of decades of neglect. Neglect by, you know, by governments of the right and of the left. You know, the system is very decentralized, so the states run the prisons, you know, the vast majority of them. And it's just they haven't paid attention to prisons. I mean, it's something that, you know, when you talk to people on the street and you say, you know, I'm going to invest in prisons, you know, but politicians probably think, well, I'm not going to get any votes with that, you know, with that line. But the issue, I mean, there is obviously an issue of rights, you know. We are a human rights organization, and we defend basic human rights for everybody, including people who commit crimes or are accused of committing crimes. But there is this issue of public security. As long as Brazil doesn't control its prisons, it's not going to be able to make significant inroads against crime, you know. There were 60,000 homicides in Brazil in 2016, that's the last year we have data for. It's a huge number. And part of that is because of these very strong gangs that recruit in prisons.
Well, Cesar Munoz, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
You're tuned into Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about prison violence in Brazil, where enormous overcrowding and gang violence has led to a spate of deadly riots over the past year. We just heard from Cesar Munoz of Human Rights Watch. To broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in three other guests who have been following the issue closely. First, we'll welcome back to the show Brad Brooks in Sao Paulo. He's the chief Brazil correspondent for Reuters. And joining us from Miami is Mike Lasusa. He's a senior Brazil researcher at Insight Crime, a group that researches organized crime in Latin America. And in London, we're joined by Sacha Dark. He's a senior lecturer in criminology at the University of Westminster, who, among other things, researches life inside Brazilian prisons. Welcome to all of you. Mike Lasusa, let me start with you. I understand that there are a couple of large gangs that control many of Brazil's prisons. One of them is called Primeiro Capital Command or First Capital Command. Tell us just a little bit about this gang. How did it get started? What does it do?
Right. So the PCC, as they're commonly known, actually started in prison as a prisoner rights group of sorts, and eventually evolved into a gang. As you heard Cesar mention, one major reason for the formation of gangs in prisons is protection of the inmates, given the horrible conditions there. So this gang has expanded over the past several decades and has become now a serious international criminal organization that's engaged in drug trafficking, extortion, and all kinds of other criminal activities.
Okay, so that's interesting, though, but it started in prison as a way for prisoners to try to assert their rights or just to be safe, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Well, Brad Brooks, let me turn this to you then. What got a lot of attention was this big series of riots that happened in early 2017. You've covered that for Reuters. Tell us just a little bit about what was sort of unusual and sort of uniquely horrific about these.
Well, I mean, it was an explosion of violence that Brazil had not seen for, some years. I mean, there have been deadly prison riots pop up annually in Brazil. What happened last year was that these deadly riots, in which, 60 inmates were killed in one, upward of that in another within a span of a few weeks, these were taking place in the Amazonian region of Brazil. And what they clearly were the gangs. The PCC was trying to take control of really lucrative cocaine smuggling routes up there in the Amazon. And so these were essentially clashes with a local gang that was, in fact, being backed by Brazil's second largest gang, which is called the Red Command and is based in Rio de Janeiro, and which used to have a kind of loose partnership with the first Capital Command, the strongest gang in Brazil.
And so what happened then was that partnership obviously broke down and there was this conflict over drug trafficking, which led to the violence.
Right. Depending on who you talk to, which prosecutors talk to, which researcher you speak with, how that broke down. But it was basically a fight for the border, Brazil's border with Paraguay, and control of drug smuggling routes on that border. It used to be sort of co-managed by the cocaine that used to come over that route used to be co-managed by the PCC and the Red Command. And then the PCC made a move. They killed the main drug baron in Paraguay and basically pushed the Red Command aside, took over that route. And through that area is where much of the cocaine, the really export quality cocaine that comes from Peru, that comes from Bolivia, it comes in through Paraguay. It comes into Brazil through Paraguay.
Well, Sacha Dark, let me turn this to you because you have done a lot of research on Brazilian prisons. You're writing a book about life inside prisons. I understand you've actually spent a few weeks living in a Brazilian prison. Talk to us just a little bit about what, from the prisoner's perspective, like what good these gangs serve.
Yeah, I feel I've probably got the short straw a little bit here. I'm certainly not promoting gangs at all, and I agree with what the other speakers have said, that prisoners are literally left to their own devices. The state is not fulfilling its obligations towards them. I think what I'm interested in is the sort of history of prisoner organisations, of which, to a certain extent, gangs have sort of latched onto. So when I say the order that gangs bring, I'm thinking more really in terms of prisoners organizing, which sometimes turns into a gang and sometimes does not. So so obviously, very, very shortly, you would say we've talked about protection. Gangs do day-to-day reduce violence. Obviously, it's a very fragile system and horrible things can happen when these systems break down. They're also there to provide what the state isn't providing to prisoners, in particular, anything more than the most basic three meals a day that prisons do provide. Sometimes they don't even provide that. And they provide certainty to prisoners. They provide systems of alternative dispute resolution, which, to a certain extent, allow people to remain safe and to to be able to make deals with other people and know that if they go wrong, there'll be somebody to enforce those.
So in other words, then it sounds like the gangs inside the prisons provide sort of like almost a justice system where if somebody does something wrong, somebody steals something, somebody attacks someone else, there's a system in place to sort of work through the conflict.
There is. They even use the English word debates. They do have... it depends on the part of the country. I think in the north of the country, the gang system is still very, very little developed. But if we look at somewhere like São Paulo, where it's very, very developed, then sure. I mean, the problem with this system, of course, is that what's the penalty they have? They only have violent penalties. So it's not a system which is at all good, but you can say it's better than having no system of justice at all.
Well, let me move this to Mike Lasuza then. Talk to us just a little bit about the situation for prison guards, for prison staff here. Oh, I'm sorry, we just lost Mike, but let me pose that to you, Brad Brooks. Why aren't prison guards, why aren't prison staff, why isn't the Brazilian state able to halt this kind of violence? Why don't they just come in and sort of wipe out these gangs?
Ah, that's a great question. And it mostly has to do with the fact that the first Capital Command, for instance, in a matter of hours, they could bring Sao Paulo, South America's largest city that I'm sitting in, a city of more than 20 million people, to a complete standstill. They have the firepower as a gang to take on police forces and put them on their heels. And the last time, you know, they have these sort of quiet wars with the police constantly. But for instance, in 2006, the PCC, when they were a much weaker gang, they during a month, they basically shut down Sao Paulo, South America's economic hub, and they could easily do it again. And so, you know, you can never get politicians to confirm this. But it's certainly the widespread thought is that politicians know that they have to essentially meet with the heads of these gangs and negotiate truces, negotiate peaces. And this happens, you know, before Carnival every year. It happens before big events that Brazil has held. It's just a fact of life that these gangs are as powerful as the security forces in Brazil.
And so, in other words, it sounds like if Brazil went to war against these gangs, it would be extremely violent. It sounds like it may be analogous to what happened in Mexico in recent years when the Mexican state tried to sort of shoot its way out of a cartel problem.
Absolutely. And I would argue that you would see even more deaths in Brazil than in Mexico, perhaps just because of the population. But the PCC and the Red Command, along with some powerful regional gangs, if the state, whether the federal state or the at the state level, if the security forces actually really earnestly tried to take them on and wipe them out, it would lead to tens of thousands of deaths.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's show, we're talking about prison conditions in Brazil, where gangs and overcrowding have led to a series of deadly riots in recent months. We're joined by Brad Brooks of Reuters in Sao Paulo, also by Sasha Dark, a senior lecturer in criminology at the University of Westminster, and by Cesar Munoz of Human Rights Watch. If you're interested in more Global Journalists, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues, including a series of recent interviews with international journalists forced to flee their home countries. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, or check out our video cast on YouTube. And Sasha Dark, I wanted to ask you about the drug laws in Brazil. I understand that about 12 years ago, there was some sweeping legislation that was passed that changed drug laws in Brazil in a way, I think that it was analogous to some changes that the U.S. made in its own drug laws 25, 30 years ago. Talk to us about how that has affected the dynamic in prisons.
That's a very, very interesting question. It's certainly one of the main contributors to this enormous rise in the prison population we've seen in Brazil in the last 10 or 20 years. But it's also, to a certain extent, you could almost say made prisoners more conscious of the biases of the of the penal system, because most people who are now, you know, from poor areas in Brazil who are found with any amount of drugs on them are automatically given 5-year prison sentences. And so now we have a situation where there's a lot of young men in prison, for very small, sometimes very small quantities of drugs. And this obviously affects the dynamic in prison itself. But I would say probably not necessarily to a negative extent. A lot of people there who are in for minor drug offences, having to find ways to survive in these spaces and to get together and to form what we sometimes call gangs.
And Brad Brooks, if I could turn this back to you then, because what you were describing earlier, it makes it sound like there's actually that there's an issue with corruption that goes beyond just sort of prison guards here, and that it sounds like it may be that there are, I mean, to what extent are there officials in the Brazilian state itself that are advocates on behalf of these gangs in the same way that sort of in Mexico you see almost whole states being captured by the cartels?
I don't think it's as extensive as you see in Mexico, to be perfectly honest. The PCC, for instance, it's a little more complicated, and I'm sorry, hesitating, but the PCC, for instance, they elect their own members. They get their own members elected to city councils, to be state congressmen, and so they've learned to work from inside the system. The Brazilian police force, of course, has a reputation for being notoriously corrupt, for selling drugs and guns directly to the gangs themselves, being bought off. So that's a major problem. But in terms of like it reaching the level of Mexico and federal officials being bought off, you don't really see much of that. And maybe perhaps Sasha could speak more to that. I don't know. But I, as a reporter, I mean. Federal officials are bought off in many ways, as has been seen in Brazil's major corruption investigations in recent years, but not so much by the drug gangs.
Well, Cesar Munoz, I'd like to bring you back into the discussion as well, because one aspect of this that we haven't touched on is Brazil's juvenile detention centers. Talk to us just a little bit about what those are like. These are places that are meant to rehabilitate child offenders.
Right. Yeah, so the system here is called socio-educational, juvenile units, they call them. But this is total euphemism, because some of these units are prisons, really. I mean, in Ceará, where you had those riots, recently, last week, I was there last year, and I saw children who were kept in the rooms for 24 hours a day. I mean, they had no activities, zero. We see that the system is not, in many of these states, is not helping. I mean, it's supposed to help children, give them a chance to turn their lives around, and it's not doing that. And we already see the influence of gangs there. So that didn't happen in the past, but we have. We already see that, for example, in Rio de Janeiro, in Ceará as well. And so that's very dangerous.
Well, Sacha Dark, let me ask you about what you see as some potential solutions to this issue, to this problem within the prisons. What might the Brazilian government be doing that they're not doing now?
I don't think there's any choice but to invest in the prison system. I think if you have a situation that's been described as you have now, where guards are literally unable to provide for the safety of prisoners, there's too few of them to even go inside prisons, then I think if we leave this void of governance, it's going to be filled to some extent, or positive things will happen, but obviously gangs can gang mentality could turn out to be very, very bad as well. So I think the government literally has to invest in its prison system, and probably the best way to do that is to start off by seriously reducing the number of people it sends to prison.
Well, and Cesar Munoz, I want to ask you as well, when we look at these these riots, I guess you could call them massacres, that have killed more than 130 people last year, several dozen people this month, why isn't the government able to separate the gangs into different parts of the prison so that they're not killing each other?
Right. They actually have started doing that. For example, in Roraima, it's the northernmost state in Brazil. There was a prison there where about 2 years ago there were some killings. So what they did, they separated the members of PCC and of the Red Command, right? So they put them in different prisons, but they didn't know where to put people who were not members of gangs. So they put them together with the PCC in the same cells. And, obviously, this is a way to help them recruit new members. And the massacre that happened there in January 2017, so a year ago, those killed were non-members, all of them. So the PCC killed, all these people who were not members of the gangs, of the gang. So, the lesson there is you have to join the gang or otherwise you're going to be killed. So the state, in answer to your question, the state is separating people, but not perfectly. And that's, the way it does it is problematic.
Well, Brad Brooks, our time does grow short here. There was a very detailed article in the America's Quarterly magazine recently talking about sort of the sophistication of the PCC and how it's really extended its reach beyond Brazil's borders now. Can you just give us some context as to the sophistication of the gang and where it sort of fits in sort of regional global threats from organized crime?
When I think about the First Capital Command, the Sao Paulo-based gang, I always tell people that they're all business. As a journalist, it's pretty easy for me to travel to Rio de Janeiro and to organize an interview with someone from the Red Command. But I've never been able to have such luck with any of the top gang leaders from the First Capital Command. What I hear from prosecutors who have been after the First Capital Command for over a decade is that they've already become South America's most powerful gang. Some people dispute that. They definitely control the flow of cocaine from South America to Africa and onto Europe and directly to Europe. They have ties with Russian and Italian mafias and other European gangs. And what prosecutors here tell me is that the First Capital Command has absolutely wants to become the most powerful cartel in all of the Americas. They want to surpass the Mexican cartels. Whether or not they can do that is, time will tell, but they are diversifying and doing everything that they can as a gang to become successful.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Cesar Munoz, Brad Brooks, Mike LaSouza, and Sasha Dark for joining us. Our producers this week are Raina Sims and Lauren Workman, with assistance from Idom Kasae. Jiwon Choi is our visual editor. Our audio engineer is Aaron Hay, and Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.